This week's episode is brought to you by Luke James, Friendly Leviathan, and James McCool. Thank you, Luke James, Friendly Leviathan, and James McCool. It's with the generous support of listeners just like you that we here at The Whole Rabbit keep our unmanned anti-gravity drone surveillance network outfitted with enough quantum processing units to locate anomalous brainwave signals from the etheric network so we can implant, through wireless hypnosis, a form of transient desire to travel to our subterranean headquarters and offer themselves up for an interview. If you'd like to help us keep our interview guests held against their will in an undisclosed location, or just hear the second half of this episode, then please visit www.patreon.com/thewholerabbit, where your monthly donation of just $5 will not only get you the greatly extended version of this exclusive interview, but you'll get access to our entire library of extended uncensored content that, after logging in, you can conveniently browse from right within Spotify on your desktop or mobile device. If you don't have a mobile device, you can always pledge your $5 to me through Esoteric Ritual, and the demon spawn of the seventh dimension will come to collect it in the form of toenails on the second Sunday of each month until your debt is paid. If you're enjoying the free show well enough and would rather save your $5 for a pair of refurbished nipple clips and a package of pixie sticks, then please consider giving our humble podcast a like, subscribe, or share on your social media platform of choice, because the algorithm thinks we're a sketchy rabbit selling business who says words that make computers feel threatened. If you've already got nipple clips and Andrew Jackson is burning a hole in your pocket, our Patreon also has a $20 tier which earns you, besides the normal gifts, a monthly tarot reading with yours truly, where I tell you the exact time, date, and circumstances of your great-grandfather's illegal vasectomy, the most important thing to know when doing your birth chart. On this week's episode, we're joined by Ixender, known widely on the internet as Alawite Anon, the same fellow whose anonymous post on 4chan went viral a few weeks ago and found itself as the topic of discussion for our episode dubiously labeled Interview with a Gnostic Muslim. As fate would have it, he tracked us down, and instead of punching us in the nose, which was probably warranted, he offered himself up as a subject of interview about his ancient faith and the occult tenets contained therein. In the free section of the show, we ask Ixender about the origins of his people and faith, the esoteric aspects of his practice, the initiatory ordeals and structure of its inner order, its little-known connection to the Knights Templar, the rejection of holiness, what occult materials they study, and if women may participate or not. While this covers quite a mountain of interesting information, we do go quite a bit deeper in the extended episode as we talk about the magical mother letters AMS, advanced astral travel, the anatomy of the human soul, the origin of the demiurge, if gods can die, the highest principle, how to deal with demons, the tree of life, the archons or sultans of this reality, the earth gates where they reside as guardians, the adversary or shadow entity, Lucifer, and finally, what cosmically horrific thing happens when we die. So buckle up, thank you, and enjoy the show.
One's good. Yeah.
Why did the hawk sit on the church's steeple?
Why?
Because it was a bird of prey.
I like that one too.
3 a.m. jokes. Yeah.
What happens if you don't pay your exorcist?
What?
You get repossessed.
Oh yeah.
Hello everybody, and welcome to The Whole Rabbit, where we don't just brazenly misrepresent the secret mystery religion of an ancient Syrian people who did nothing to deserve such injustice. Nay, we gather ourselves an actual learned emissary of this ancient people to answer our questions in his own words, tell us about his secret religion, and how we can master reality, because this week, we're interviewing Alawite Anon about the secrets of the Al-Najim. I'm your host, Luke Madrid, sometimes known as Hack Rabbit. I'm joined this week by the maker of miracles, Mari Sama.
Hallelujah, y'all.
The hibiscus, honey humanist, Heka Astra.
Hello.
And the criminally crystalline Tim Hacker of the Crypto Chronicles podcast.
Hi.
That's it? Just hi?
Hi. Hello. I'm glad to be here.
Well, thank you for coming back, Tim, because we're in different time zones from our guest today, and because Mal also has a day job like the rest of us, he could not make it today, but he will be back for our next topic. Now, just a few episodes ago, we did a show titled The Anonymous Teachings of a Gnostic Muslim, which was based on the content that Mari found in a 4chan post in the paranormal category X. Sometimes we do that when we're short on time, you know. In this case, Mari struck gold because whoever wrote this post felt like they made it especially for our audience, and we had a great time. Then, after we released the show, by some crazy turn of events, the guy who made the original 4chan post found it and reached out to us. Which is crazy, because nothing like that has ever happened before. Turns out he's not just wise, but also the type of guy you'd like to share a beer with, and he was generous enough to collaborate and come spend some time with us on the show today. So thank you for joining us, Mr. Alawite Anon.
Thank you.
Yeah, hello, everyone. Thank you very, very, very much for having me here. I'm honestly stoked to be on the show. I gotta say, right after I listened to the previous episode you guys made, I was hooked. And I had such a good time. Me and my wife had so many laughs, and we enjoyed it so much. You have made, like, two new fans, basically. Thanks.
Yay!
A lot.
Welcome.
Thank you. That's very humbling. I was almost afraid that whoever made that post would see the show, or hear the show, I guess, and be like, those bastards. Because you, technically, you're not really Gnostic or Muslim. So I kind of, you know, we're going to set the record straight today.
Thank you so much for having me here.
You're very welcome. Thank you for coming. First order of business, what do we call you? As an anonymous poster, we've only ever known you as Alawite Anon.
Well, my name is Skandar in Arabic, or Alexander in the infidel languages. You can call me whatever you guys want. Alex, Skandar, Alawite, just, you know, it's just a nickname. The previous one I used was just on the spot during those 4chan threads because it seemed appropriate, you know, for the audience at the time. But yeah, I'm Alex, and I'm very happy to meet you all.
Yeah, welcome. Nice to meet you.
Skandar?
Yeah, Skandar.
Awesome.
Well, the post you're talking about on 4chan, the one you made, it was fascinating. And for us here at The Whole Rabbit, it was interesting to see how many ideas it reflected that we had been studying in regards to Gnosticism. And of course, we'd seen echoes of it elsewhere in the occult corpus. Moreover, your religion seemed entirely unique at the same time. Since classical times, Westerners have found themselves enchanted by the magic of the Middle East. And today we hope to continue that tradition by having you share with us the wisdom of your culture and your secret faith. I suppose, first of all, why are you choosing to share your secrets with us and the rest of the internet?
You know, in the beginning, it was a form of vanity, some kind of vanity-fueled exercise that I did on 4chan. I was testing the water and seeing if, you know, anybody was interested in this sort of thing. I love everything paranormal, occult, and, you know, anything esoteric, so the thread started from there, and they sort of amalgamated and grew into, like, this serious discussion with others on Discord, and, you know, it started off as one thread and spread to seven. And now it's become this, like, knowledge preservation project. But a little background, I was basically born into this faith and raised in, like, in a small village in the mountains of Syria. And currently our situation there is that our, like, traditions and cultures, they are kind of on the edge because we're, like, surviving a pretty horrible civil war. And we're worried that our, like, you know, traditions and esoteric knowledge will, you know, one day be washed away by the, you know, by the war. So I discussed things with my elders and, like, in the community, and started this personal project of releasing, you know, whatever harmless information we can to preserve this. And I got the okay from them. And now this effort has grown into this book project of, like, a compilation of frequently asked questions about the Alawites, and specifically our, like, other order, which is, like, a subsection of the Alawiyah called Ahl al-Najm. So I'm here to share that with everyone, basically, in a way that maybe that surviving, you know, generations, when they look back and ask, okay, who are these guys? What do they believe in? Assuming the planet isn't overrun by, like, sentient AI or, you know, destroyed by them, then they'll know who we are and, you know, what kind of history we had and everything we believe in.
When we were originally doing the post, I was actually initially kind of nervous to share it, because if what you say really is secret and it's held by, you know, secret vows and everything, I was worried that if your elders found out that you were leaking information on the internet, that you'd get in trouble. But I'm glad to know that you did ask permission to release certain types of information.
That's exactly right. And everything that I've released so far is still considered right at the edge of what is, like, Zahir and Batin. It's not exactly the highly forbidden sensitive information. And even the forbidden ones aren't really that special. It's just more deeper explanations of the things I've already spoke about, basically. So it's all good. There's no trouble to anyone.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your people and where they come from. In the book you're writing, The Book of Clouds, you say the oldest name of your people, that Tabit Ziamati, means keepers of the old records. and that, quote, we do not represent Islam, Christianity, Judaism, or Zoroastrianism. We are not of the Abrahamic faiths, albeit we mask as such. What then is the true origin of your faith, and what is it currently masking as? How did it come to be what it appears as today?
Well, first, I'm really honored that you read the book, or that anybody has checked it out. It's still very much a work in progress. But as for your questions, the origin, we trace our origins back to ancient Mesopotamia, to the time where these, like, sort of mayors, priests, leaders of small localities in ancient Sumer called the Ensi. These guys ran mystery schools, and they're, like, you know, in their areas of influence in cities. And these guys, think of them as, like, fat, bald Sumerian kingpins of antiquity. And and basically, yeah. And when the Akkadian, you know, invaded their lands and, you know, took over, the Ensis and the family, they fled through the desert of Syria westward to the coastline, where they settled in Ugarit, in the northwestern city in Antioch, basically. And they brought with them all the knowledge of the mystery schools and everything that they believed in, which is allegedly pre-flood, but I'm skeptical about that. And so when they mixed their, you know, cosmology and their belief system with the Ugaritians and the mountain folks, resulting, you know, syncretic cocktail was our faith, basically. The name that you mentioned, the Chubut Shiamat, is Keepers of the Old Record. It's just an old name. Currently, we call ourselves, you know, amongst each other, we call ourselves Najmiyun or Al-Khassa, like Al-Alawiyun Al-Khassa, or in the public sense, we're just, you know, Al-Alawiyun, basically.
What is the People of the Star?
That's the official name, like Ahl al-Najm. That's like a fancy way of saying people who want to become stars, in a sense.
I love that name.
Oh, that's somehow very Thelemic.
That's the end goal, basically. And you asked me about this masking, or like why we do that. Is currently we and the public Alawiyun, from which we actually stem from, we appear as like a mutated branch of 12er Shia Islam, kinda. And this appearance is necessary because throughout history, our geographic neighbors were never really tolerant of diversity nor any belief systems that challenged the norm. I mean, can you imagine somebody in the Middle East with anti-God religion or something like that? Which is exactly what ours is. Yeah, pretty rough. And our faith basically breaks down every divinity and every god to thought forms and less fearsome levels of understanding. So, and well, I'm really hoping to dive deeply into that tonight.
Yeah, that sounds extremely fascinating, actually.
Yeah, we had to assimilate, you know, throughout history. I mean, if you look at the history of Syria, you'll see just how many empires occupied that place. And so anytime somebody asks, we'll like pretend to, you know, yeah, we're whatever you want us to be, kind of. But yeah, tonight I'm here to basically try my best to explain who we are and what we do, what we believe in. And I'm not going to break any oaths. I'm not going to get in trouble or get anybody in trouble. And to all the listeners out there, please remember, I'm not exactly like a representative or an emissary of the Alawiyun. I am basically just a dude who, let's say, quote unquote, finished his learning. And I'm here to share.
I hope this isn't offensive to say, but it sounds a little bit like the Al-Hassa have some similarities to the Yazidi people, where they're surrounded by others who believe that their philosophy or worldview is somehow heretical to their own, and they're slowly being exterminated.
You are very correct in the comparison. The Yazidiyin, they have a very specific belief system in which their deity, or let's say what they worship, isn't exactly compatible with the rest of Islam, and so it put them in a lot of tough spots throughout history. So yeah, they also practice the same exact way of taqiyya and kitman, not to show who they really are, and save their lives, basically.
Now, you mentioned your religion has a bit of an inverse perspective on God and holiness. Naturally, you would want to keep it hidden in an area where that would draw hostility. That being said, would it be accurate to call your religion Gnostic, mystical, or esoteric?
I would say we are heavily esoteric, as the overwhelming vast majority of our books are basically written allegories and poetry. So a student really has to dig through the symbols and figure out what they mean. As for Gnostic, I'm actually really happy you asked that, because I want to set the record straight. No, we are not Gnostics. We are not Gnostic Muslims, but we are as much Gnostic as we are Hindu, Kabbalist, Zoroastrian, or Neoplatonists. So the only resemblance here is that all these rivers came from the same source, from the same cosmology, and we believe that all the other people that I just mentioned now, they have just different interpretations. So sure, we agree on the concept of this divine, unknowable monad that splits and forms the world. We do have the concept of the demiurge somewhat in our like cosmology, but it's not the exact same one as the one in Gnosticism. Another interesting place where we, you know, interject with them is Sophia. We have Sophia also in our faith, and her name is Sufa. She also birthed the chaotic understanding, Bina, the sun, the Awim. So we are similar to Gnosticism, but we're not exactly the same thing. To my understanding, we also have parallels with the Kabbalah and the Taoists. For example, the Kabbalists, they also have their own, interpretation of Sophia and the Eitz Chaim and the tree and the sphere of Chokmah, if I'm not mistaken. So what I'm trying to say is that we agree with all these traditions. We are basically looking at the same thing and just interpreting it differently. The Gnostics sort of animated it a little bit more than the others, If anything, our faith can be described as leaning towards Sumerian and Neoplatonic philosophies combined.
Thank you. That actually does set the record straight. It borrows from the same stream as other wisdom traditions, but it's the one stream nonetheless.
That's the way I've always looked at it as well.
The name of this podcast sort of implies that idea, you could say. So I'd say we're big subscribers to that concept in general. Now, I've got to take the bait. You said something I found compelling. Often on the show, I speak of my fluke success invoking Sophia, which radically and permanently changed my outlook on the universe. I've had my share of mystical experiences, but this one in particular, the one I call my theophany, was on an entirely different level. Theophany meaning what manifestation of a deity. In this case, I felt like Sophia came to me personally. Now I've been calling her Sufa in preparation for this episode. Sounds kind of like sofa, like something I could recline on, which the universe sort of does in a way. One element that played into my fluke success was regular devotion to an archangel of Hakma, Raziel, and by way of their sigil. I've often wondered if this was a factor in how my experience played out. Perhaps if I'd been using a sigil sacred to Tifereth, I'd be a born-again Christian right now. After the experience, I felt as if all the seeds of doubt or ontological skepticism inside of me had been burned up, and I was left to assume that this is whatever the Gnostics had called Gnosis.
Well, cracking open a sphero will do that to you. Yeah, it seems like. That experience is what we hope for every candidate to go through, the yaqeen, the understanding, but we're just talking about different sphera. Yours was with Chokmah, and ours mainly focuses on Tiferet. So, I mean, if we're talking in the Kabbalistic terminology here. But you know what? I'm going to leave the Kabbalah to the Ahlul Kabbalah, because it's not ours, it's theirs. I'm not going to dive too much into that. In your experience with Sufa, the divine recliner, sounds very fascinating. She is, and it's very, very based. It isn't an everyday occurrence for someone to withstand that radiance of wisdom itself.
Well, I went a little nuts. It was a heavy gnosis to take, but now I know it, and I paid the price and I'd pay it again. Now, I said the word gnosis. You said yaqeen. What is that exactly?
So, before talking about the yaqeen, I need to clarify a little bit about the cosmology, just to give like a map for everyone. We believe that the material world, the one we're living in, the 3D, all of matter, everything that is here in this energy range is condensed. In the beginning it was like a dense sphere, like an apple, basically. And then there's this external mental creature, like a ghost, ethereal thing that dwells in higher dimensions outside the one we're in. It has 7 layers, and the core of it is basically the awareness. It's like the ego of it, the I am, This creature wraps itself around this material world, right? And it penetrates it, and it expands it, right? This is our own, mountainous, peasantly explanation of the Big Bang, if you will. Our faith believes that this creature expanded the world and started to, permutate everything inside, like all the universe, all the solar systems, the planets, down to the smallest, detail. And through night travel, which is another thing that I'm hoping that we visit tonight, through projection, you can reach this yaqeen, this gnosis which you speak of, and it's a shared vision of sorts inside that realm, inside the mind of God. Something I cannot describe, because if I do, first of all, it's forbidden in my language, in my faith to do that. It would defeat the purpose of the entirety of our teachings if I talk about it. But it is attained through night travel, and it's an experience, just like the one you had.
Okay, so what's night travel?
Night travel is you dive in.
Is that like astral projection or like OBE?
It is exactly astral projection.
Ah.
So when you night travel, you are to use these like specific letters inside the, the area there. Well, it's not really an area, but, there. And using that, it will get you to a specific layer where you will have this shared yaqeen, this shared exact same understanding that everybody else has the same one. And just because of this being the same thing that I experienced, you experienced, and someone else experienced, this sort of validates successful travel in a sense.
Awesome.
This is what Aleister Crowley meant with his phrase he was so fond of.
The method of science, the aim of religion.
In so much as this is an experiment that if you do correctly, it has a repeatable result that you can verify, or what's the phrase they use? Peer review? You can show it with others and share in your experience together.
It's replicatable results, yeah.
If I may tell you exactly how it's done and the amount, this is like kind of hush-hush, but I can talk about it. And the culmination of the... we have four initiations. Between the third and the fourth, there's the yaqeen, where the candidate exits the body, has the experience. We are not allowed to tell him what it is beforehand, so it doesn't soil the experience here. Because if I tell, for example, the person who's about to go through that experience, you're going to see a huge golden bird, right? So if he does experience that, or his mind translates that, then that's because of what I said. It's not really any yaqeen or any gnosis. It's just me influencing his psyche, his mind. But if I keep my mouth shut, he has an experience, or she has an experience. They come back and they give us tiny signs. We have three specific signs, which I mentioned in the book, like tiny signs that are related to the yaqeen. Then we give them the document, which contains the full description. And 99.9% of the time, it's exactly what they experienced.
Awesome. This sounds a lot like the best of what occult practice has to offer, because what we know about Western magic, you're given a series of grade signs as you progress through your initiations, which you then are intended to use astrally in the dream realm to communicate with or verify spirits that you encounter, etc. And so it seems obvious that you would need to obscure the fact that you are doing an occult practice in a place where, presumably, an accusation of witchcraft or sorcery would be very bad. So in your book, you say that your people have protected themselves and their inner beliefs through a form of taqiyya or kitman. What is that exactly?
The taqiyya and the kitman are just basically fancy Arabic words for keep your mouth shut. Essentially, exactly, it's, you know, essentially taqiyya is the practice of pretending to belong to a faith. So you maintain your own beliefs to yourself or to your community, and outwardly you project this other belief. So this makes us kind of like, you know, chameleons in a sense. It's done for personal safety. It's not done to like trick anybody or for any malicious intent. It's just that because the Middle East is very hostile, and as you can imagine, 80% of our belief is just not going to be compatible with anything around us. So that's why we do taqiyya. And kitman is basically your ability to keep a secret. Both of these are considered essential for survival in Syria, especially now, you know, during the civil war. And these practices may seem kind of antisocial and weird and like, you know, sociopathic in a sense, but they have saved countless lives throughout history.
That's brilliant. Yeah, it's like one of the first things that you learn in most mystery traditions is the talent of silence.
It reminds me of to know, dare, will, and keep silent.
Yeah, and I've heard of taqiyya before. I'm actually familiar with that. I believe that Judaism has some form of that as well.
I mean, I can give like a very small example of that. Circa 2009 to 2016, if I open my mouth about anything remotely related to our religion, I would be in like deep shit, basically. So taqiyya is wearing a cross, going to church every Sunday, or, you know, mosque, just whatever river you vibe with, and just nodding and smiling, basically. Otherwise, how would we survive? Because our faith is so anti everything around us, basically.
I believe Maimonides lived like that for many years, and without him, we really wouldn't have Jewish mysticism as we know it today. So it's not an unprecedented thing to carry the wisdom tradition with a mask through a greater mainstream culture.
In a way, that's how it's always survived.
I feel bad for the people that are worried about satanic conspiracies everywhere, because it kind of counts, you know? But in reality, they're hiding because bad things would happen if people knew, like...
Yeah, free speech isn't really that free yet.
Yeah, and I guess that's why people view that form of protection as perhaps like it's a more malicious thing, like lying, because in Western societies, we have the concept of free speech. So it's like a different, I guess it's like a different playing field almost.
Not lying, like maybe like what he said, masking. But yeah, I get what you're saying.
Or misdirection, misinformation.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, misdirection is perfect.
There's also another aspect to this, to the taqiyya. It's basically, I want you to imagine like an average Joe in Syria. Very content and happy, and the basic entry-level Islam fits him perfectly. He's happy, he's content. His life fits, everything is okay. and he doesn't need any more depth or any esoteric aspects. No night travel, no, you know, latching on to like grand principalities, no. So if you go there and to this person and you have a conversation and you break down everything that they believe in a sense, you're kind of altering their life to the worse, because you're going to cause discord and chaos inside their mind. And sometimes people are just not ready for this. That's why you cannot really learn. Most of the esoteric knowledge is found in every mystery school, unless you go there of your own free will and accord and basically ask for it. That's another reason why, you know, taqiyya is important.
Absolutely. And some people can't handle it if, like, the little box is shaken. They take it as, like, a personal attack against their very being.
It becomes a matter of their identity.
Yeah, their ego gets involved.
So, to paint a better picture of this, from what I understand, all the males in your faith are sort of expected to participate in the faith. And there are two initiations into this faith that are a bit misleading. There's something else going on underneath the surface. Please talk about those two first initiations and why does it work this way?
So the candidate, which is mostly males, females can join too, but like you said, males are expected. So you're a man now. It's time for you to learn the faith. There's like societal pressure. There's like peer pressure, friends, older brothers, uncles, fathers. They start to wink, wink, elbow poke. It's time for you to learn, etc. So they steer the person, but they have to ask for it. When they do, they undergo four initiations in total. The first two are bullshit. They're just basically misleading noise. And I'm being honest, you know, the purpose of which is just to weed out like the docile mind, which will accept anything that they are told. I mean, some of the stuff in the first two initiations are so ridiculous that you would have to be, you know, just, you're not using any brain cells to, you know, to really digest them or to, you know, unfold
them.
That's
great.
Yeah, and they crank up the like the complexity. I mean, tomes upon tomes, like one book is like 400 pages, the other one is like 300, to the point where the candidate doesn't know his own name anymore. It's just like so many things. Are you finished that risala? Read this one. Have you finished this book? Read that one. And so they keep going and going. And if they don't wake up and say, well, okay, stop, this is crap, at some point, then they don't advance. And there's a test. There's an actual, like a physical, literal ritual that we do, like a test of submission at the end of the second initiation. And if they're like goody two shoes and they just, you know, they do exactly as they're told and they recite everything and they sort of submit in that test, then they stop and that's it. They don't advance anywhere. They remain in the, what's it called? The Amma, the public section of the Alawiyah. The ones who reject that, they advance. And the reason we need the candidate to reject this nonsense is because the nature of the upper world, the actual thing that we're studying thousands of years now, is like a cosmic funhouse filled with all kinds of illusions and smokes and mirrors. I mean, it's the mental world of God. So if the candidate can't push through the bullshit here in the waking world and maintain skepticism and willpower to do that, then they're definitely not ready for any kind of night travel or to understand the, you know, the larger picture up there. You need a rock solid bullshit detector. Otherwise, none of this will make any sense. And part of this is also rejecting, you know, if you learn to sort of be skeptical and to question everything in front of you, then the culmination of that is in the afterlife. When the person passes away and is presented with all that they are presented with after that. So you need to be able to clear the smoke and noise and focus on what is actual in these first two initiations. And these are like filtering systems that decide, you know, if, okay, is this guy or this girl really up for it? Can we go through with like projection and, you know, a whole shebang after that? Or are they just gonna let go? And sadly, the vast majority just, you know, they nod and you know, they go on with their life and they're given a pat on the back and they're also congratulated, you know, the ones who don't pass the test. They're given this kind of like a mock congratulation and, you know, they're given more of the zahiri esoteric, quote unquote esoteric knowledge that they were studying with and they can just continue reading those, you know, forever.
What you say makes a lot of sense because every wisdom tradition I can think of warns you to not take things that you experience in dreams or on the astral level at face value. You're expected to test the spirits and to have, you know, be able to filter out some things because it's a wild west out there and they will mislead you. Now, how exactly do they separate these two groups of people? What is the ordeal that they put you through that makes you either accept or reject? Is it just like a slow buildup over time? You're just like, okay, you're feeding me nonsense. Or is there like a culmination to it?
Oh, no. no, it's a climax. It's It's a very violent... Okay, so at the end of the second initiation, you are... The reason you're doing the second initiation is to recite secrets, right? And you're given these, like, poetic verses and stuff. And you have to recite them back to the committee and, you know, prove your worth, so to speak. And they make this, like, a fake mock execution where they say, huh, you have not done your part. You've broken the oath. You're not reciting things right. You're not, you know, you've lost the charge. You haven't done it right. And for that, you must be punished. And they drag you to this middle of nowhere, you know, and like a different hall where everybody's dressed in black. And it's so ceremonial and it's so, you know, creepy. And everybody's giving you these like ominous looks. And they rough you up. They just tell you, okay, if you don't seek mercy immediately from, you know, God and his emissary on earth, this guy right here. And, you know, they're like titles in the assembly and everything. So they make you bend over, like kneel and kiss the leg and, you know, that whole thing. And if you fight back, they kind of escalate the violence until you actually submit. And the only ones that actually make it, you guys out there who are listening, who are about to take this initiation, focus very well, listen very well. That's the moment where you need to fight back. You need to say, okay, I don't care. Like, whatever you guys do, I'm not, you know, kissing any legs. I'm not, you know, submitting to anything, and, you know, fuck this, I'm not doing that. And you have to sort of show some kind of metal, some kind of like rejectionist, you know, vibe inside you. And when you do that, when you push away, they let go and you are, well, congratulated basically for, you know, kind of like showing your metal. It's kind of theatrical, but, you know, the problem is that the violence is real. I mean, I walked out of that thing with a bruised face, you know, like my cheek was like an apple size basically. But yeah, it was worth it.
Gotta weed out the weak.
This independent rejection of religious narrative, I think, is probably something that many of our listeners can relate to, including myself. For example, going to church since childhood before having the independent notion that I'm not getting the whole picture. Questions are left unanswered and chalked up by the church to lack of faith or something like that. And it's intriguing that this mechanism of rejection is built into your group's practices alongside a net of sorts to confirm those suspicions and assist in breaking through beyond that. I feel like if this practice was more common in the Western world, that perhaps the absolute rejection of spirituality in the form of atheism or biased scientism would be less clutched onto by the people who reject the narratives in the religions. And as far as spirituality is concerned, at least in my personal opinion and experience, the connection and meaning of spirituality is not something that will take if it's imposed upon you. It's something that only takes if you seek it of your own free will. And that does often involve rejection of what is the imposed narrative.
Well said.
It reminds me a lot of the Knights Templar for some reason, and all of the accusations that were made in France of their initiation rituals. And while those were obviously trumped up to get them burnt at the stake to persecute them, all we really have is our intuition to tell us, like, did they have some ritual kind of like that? It sort of seems like they did.
What if I don't want to kiss the butt?
You have to kiss the butt! Or his butt. Or if we ask you, you gotta jerk me off. That's how this works. Welcome to the Knights Templar. Have you met our friend Baphomet?
In Finding Nemo, he touches the butt.
He does.
They did have a weird ritual concerning a decapitated head.
Is that in the Knights Templar or in the Scottish Rite South jurisdiction of... Oh, it's in both. Okay. Well, okay.
But the secret behind this decapitated head ritual is pretty obvious. I'm sure that the Rabbit King already knows where I'm going with this. It's John the Baptist.
Is that related to the headless rite?
No, not the headless rite. It's basically just John the Baptist veneration. It's not a real decapitated head. You know what I'm saying? You know who John the Baptist is, right?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, we do. So okay. The ritual you're talking about is symbolic for his decapitated head. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, but it's also okay to trip people out. Well, it was to trip people out.
That's very interesting. Can you tell me more about the goat ritual? Do you know anything about that?
Which one? With Azazel?
I'm not sure. There's a lot of jokes going around about goat riding and goat kissing and goat tickling and...
Okay, now that we've brought up goat tickling, is there any relationship between your traditions and those of Freemasonry or the Knights Templar?
That's a really tough question. Because the connection between Freemasonry and the Templar themselves is unclear to me. Perhaps some vein of truth lies hidden somewhere in some degree in the, like, York Rite or Scottish Rite. I'm not sure. But first, let me say that I'm not a Freemason. I hold no Masonic, you know, affiliations currently. The big emphasis on currently, as this may change, like, in the near future. Personally, I think there's something to it, to Freemasonry, so you know, fingers crossed. But, you know, to answer your original question, the Knights of the Temple of Solomon were our buddies, basically. Those, I can answer about those. They were like our besties. They used to, this is documented history. Our mountains are riddled with like little forts and caves and carvings and everything. The reason for that is that as they were making their journeys to the, like, to the Holy Lands and, you know, protecting, quote unquote, protecting the pilgrims and not at all to do anything else, they traveled through our mountains. You know, they were going through these like mountainous passes and, you know, roads. And they were doing that to avoid banditry and attacks from like both sides of the mountain, from the coast of Antioch or, you know, from the hills of Hama and stuff like that. In our mountains, they basically sought refuge during the night and we provided sanctuary and protection. And in some cases, these folks, they actually sought the Nejmi teachings. They got initiated. And this interaction underscores the importance of being conduits between, like, of cultural and spiritual exchange between Europe and the Holy Land. They're like the vein, you know, connecting these two worlds. And they did this not just with us, they did this with the Ismailis, they did this with the some of the Kabbalists also in Jerusalem. They essentially, they went there and they were doing a lot of digging near the temple, and they took a lot of artifacts and teachings and traditions from there and transferred them back to Europe. And when they were in our mountains, some of them actually went through the four initiations, all of them. They finished everything. They know what we know, let's say, and Whoa. They do what we do. Yeah. And so I'm not making the bold claim that we are the origin. We are not the origin. I don't think anybody knows what or where their original rituals come from. But I can see a clear imprint between our cultures and theirs.
As it, nobody knows about where the Templars got their esoteric tradition. It just comes out of nowhere. They originally were just Christian knights. So that makes perfect sense that they got it from you.
Not us. Not us. I'm not even sure we got it from us. Let me tell you how it goes. So
somewhere
there's
along
like this,
the line, they became like mystical.
Yes. And that happened in my personal humble opinion, from what I read, it happened in Constantinople, not in our mountains. But in our mountains, they learned the blindfold and the tied hand and the clockwise motion and stuff like that. I don't think that what they believed in, like their esoteric practices, is strictly Nejmi stuff. But we have, like, let's say, if they had a library, we'd have a book there. But that's all I'm saying.
Oh, yeah. Because just like how you guys see everything as the same stream, the Templars saw it the same way, too. They venerated all the gods. Like, they didn't think that one god was overall. Like, they were down with Muhammad. They were down with Jews. They were down with everybody.
I would very much be interested in doing, like, a full-on comparison, like an academic comparison one of these days.
To them, it was, like, the same thing, just different label.
Yeah.
And that's why in Masonry, if we are going to go along with the whole narrative that the Freemasons are the surviving Knights Templar, that's why in Masonry, the one rule to join them, two rules. The main rule to join them basically is you have to believe in a higher power.
I created gingivitis.
It doesn't matter what that higher power is, the name you give it.
That's actually the first rule in ours also. So there's another one, another checklist. But hold on a second. The higher power should be anything. That's what we kind of, you know, it's not specifically that one specific god or that specific god. It's your
same thing in Masonry. Yeah.
That's also very chematic because, you know, if they had people come over with their gods from their lands, they'd be like, oh, okay, yeah, that's cool. We call those Nehru by these names. That's cool.
Now, because so many take these initiations but don't make it to the third, are people aware that there's a third and a fourth, that there's a higher level teaching and that they didn't make it? Is that something they know, and they know that there's others walking around with that higher knowledge or no?
This is kind of like the moon landing. Because there's knowing and then there's confirming. So people who live in the community, they hear stuff, they see stuff, they see people preparing, wearing the robes, but they don't know what's going on. And they believe it's just, oh, we're just celebrating the spring, or, you know, things can appear as other things. And the Najmis, the Khassa, we protect our, you know, Taqiyya again, you know, we protect what we believe in very, very, very well. And we take oaths and stuff like that. So the majority of the people don't really know what happens behind those closed doors. They just know that there are closed doors. That's how it goes, basically. So the answer, you know, the short answer is that people don't really know. They just have an idea that it happens, and that's it.
In the book, you discuss the idea of spiritual uncles as part of the initiatory process. What are these uncles?
Yes, the infamous uncle. So imagine a grumpy Dumbledore or Gandalf dude with tattooed hands, and it's just, they have to be like, they have to fit that role, you know? Every uncle has a really long beard. I don't know why. It's just, it's like a stereotype. But anyway, the uncles are a serious answer. They are like elder Alawiya assembly members. They should have been there for at least 7 to 10 years, I mean, depending on what role he has to play in Journey. They are like the mentor of the candidates. They're like spiritual guru, you know? These guys, they cannot take more than 10 students, and there's a reason for that. We were also obsessed with numbers for some reason in the Najmi. And before you ask, there's sadly no 50 Shades of Grey action involved between the student and the uncle.
I mean, after all, we shared everything, you and I.
I mean, no erotic aspect, you know?
Oh, man.
At least in our faith, although I have thoroughly enjoyed all the jokes from 4chan and, you know, Discord, Reddit, and everywhere. So, yeah. These grumpy old f***s, if I can say, basically become your spiritual fathers, right? The more you invest in the teachings, the more they give you. So they are like your library, in a sense. Like, oh, you finished that book. That's very interesting. Well, here, have 5 more. So, yeah, they are usually, they love to do that. They love to play that role. And they've been in and out of the realm which we study, like the cloud of ideas, like a gazillion times, and they enjoy, you know, bossing you people around. So, for instance, I'm going to give you like a small story. My uncle had me build him a cabinet for no reason whatsoever, just, you know, Zen stuff. You're going to build a cabinet, okay? I've never touched wood in my life, but you're still going to build a cabinet. I somehow managed to build something that looks like a cabinet. And I delivered, you know, my project. And here you go, uncle. I hope this is, you know, fitting. And he said, well, this is for you. I'm going to fill it with books and put it in your house. So this is the kind of shit they do. You know, that's who they are. They play like this kind of like a mentor role in your life.
See, that sounds kind of fun. As long as they don't touch your butt.
I'm not even sure. I mean, maybe I don't remember it because, you know how it is with herbs and drinks and stuff. So.
Uh-oh.
I know where that stigma is coming from, because there's a lot of these similar practices elsewhere in the world where there's this like this really shady, creepy kind of, you know, the disciple-mentor relationships, but we don't have that. So I'm just going to clarify that over here. On air, if you're like in Syria and thinking about joining, nothing's going to happen to you. Take it easy.
Now, I wanted to touch upon this idea you mentioned earlier. Would you care to elaborate on this aversion to the idea of holiness?
Here's the answer. We view the concept of holiness, you know, as a prison to the mind. I know I'm going to piss off a lot of people who are listening, but we human beings have long feared the idea, the concept of holy, right? We think of gods and deities as these like dominant, towering, all-powerful makers and shakers of the world. And as such, we kind of forget the question why, and, you know, to be skeptical of their nature and purpose. So if you look back in history, every pantheon in existence has instilled this fear in every culture. Most fairy tales and every god I've ever read about basically puts human beings through trials and hoops and tests and, you know, drama and tragedy, and they heavily meddle with our lives and destiny. It's frankly kind of toxic, you know. We need to take them to therapy, basically. Best example of this would be our, you know, interpretation of Yahweh commanding Abraham to slaughter, you know. He just told Abraham, yeah, take your kid to the mountain and kill him, you know. And without question, the dude just drags the kid to the altar. And this is the destructive word, holy. This is the power of holy. No, we understand that they're, you know, these guys are like upper dimensionals and meddle with our life and they do all this stuff. But there's no reason, absolutely no reason to bow and kiss the ground 5 times a day or like in fear of lakes of fire. And have you guys read anything about the Zoroastrian hell? It's horrible. It's grim. It's like 7,000 pages of pure torture, basically. So the Zoroastrians are like wise and their creed is like so rich and amazing and everything, but their hell is insane. I mean, the entirety of their books is what, like 4,000 pages, and hell itself is like 9,000. So, yeah, that's what I'm trying to say. Yeah, we hold no disrespect to the religious folk of the world. It's just our personal private choice. You know, we reject this idea of a dominating divinity. The central one, the one we believe in, the one that I described before that is like forming the world, the I Am, has never forced anyone into doing anything. No, like no submission. It's not asking you to dress a certain way or to, you know, jump through hoops or do anything. It's not going to put you through hell, or you're going to put yourself through hell or heaven. Not that. And the I Am is just there. It's just forever there. And if you learn to ignore all these like little thought experiments, you know, all these like little pantheons, then you'll be just fine. And the only holiness that we actually believe in is the one inside you, you know, the light that it gave you. Any human being walking the earth that claiming divinity, you know, wearing any kind of funny hat, no matter how well decorated, no matter how, you know, golden his like Batmobile is, nothing down here is divine. We are all the same.
Agree.
Yeah, and it's interesting because along my path and my journey, I kind of learned that on my own. Like, I had this intuition about what is the I am, what is the source God. And to say, oh, I can't eat hot dogs and I have to wear a dress at all times and I can't wear synthetic fabrics or eat shrimp. Like, what are these rules? Like, that's for nothing. I mean, it's simply
about
all the holy stuff is to me. And I saw right through it, especially like with church, especially like Catholicism and all of the, you know, playing up all of the pomp and circumstance of their ritual. And that's, I do enjoy ritual, but I'm averse to this kind of glorification and holiness that you reference. And I like to see that, you know, even your mentor, you don't call him a holy man. You don't call him a priest or like, you know, a man of God or any of that stuff, because we are that. We are just human beings.
It has more power if it comes from you, not the ritual itself.
Right. And if we all are containers of that flame of the one true source, then none of us are above or below or can subjugate. And by proxy of that, even if a being is living in that higher five-dimensional realm where all the clouds are that we're going to talk about, then they're the same as us. And like, what are they to tell us how to act or what to do or to pay homage?
Precisely.
So I think that's brilliant. And it's just, I think a lot of people have that, like, it's just an intuitive knowing, like, you know, yeah, what that is, but you can't put it into words. And I just love the way that you guys do it.
Totally.
It almost feels like this is the original red pill versus blue pill.
Oh yeah. This is one of the many, many reasons I love that movie. Only if, in our case, Morpheus is like a grumpy old man and the rest of the, you know, the crew of the Nebuchadnezzar bitch slapped Neo repeatedly and told him to submit and only gave him, you know, only if he stood up bloodied and cursed them all that they gave him the red pill, so he had to fight for it. So yeah, it is exactly that.
There's one point in the film where everyone believes that Morpheus had to give his life to save Neo, and Neo's like, this is some BS. I'm not going to take that. I'm going to reject the whole prophecy about me and about everything, and I'm going to go save Morpheus, you know? So he has to go through this himself at some point. He has to deny that he's this holy, sacred thing in order to actually be the holy, sacred thing, which is kind of interesting. Neo could just download Kung Fu, but in real life, we have to read books or meditate and all of the other things as well. That said, what is the Silsilat Talim al-Nur, as it's written here on my page that I'm sure I butchered in pronunciation?
I just got to say, before I answer that question, the way you just smoothly transitioned to this was brilliant. That was so good.
Yeah, he's awesome at that.
Oh, thank you.
Smooth.
So the Silsilat Talim al-Nur is Arabic for the chain of teachings of light. It's just a fancy way of saying the curriculum, right? The library. The candidate has to go through all of these. They have to study them thoroughly. And by thoroughly, I mean he's being monitored. He's being tested. There are visits. There are hours upon hours. There's just, give me your phone. Give me the TV. Sit down and read. And basically, these are like the greatest hits of historic essential teachings before advancing into anything practical. And, you know, doing anything like night travel, cloud work, associations, the holy letters. And okay, there we go with holy again. It's not really holy, but we say holy because they are the ones that we use up there. And anything that involves the cloud work. This is from the Silsilat Talim al-Nur. These are like the selected works. And another part of it is the parallels, right, with the other world religions and cultures, going all the way back from the Sumerian stuff, which I might, you know, I want to say that the Sumerian tablets are insane. There's so many weird stuff there. But anyway, from there all the way until, let's say, late Islam, we take everything and we digest it and dissect it, and we look through the parallels of anything that has anything to do with the cloud world. And the importance of this at the fourth initiation, we kind of, you know, we take all this Silsilat Talim al-Nur, we put it aside, and we tell the candidate, okay, now you've done the theoretical, it's time for you to do the practical. They tell you the do's and don'ts of the upper cloud. That's why you've been reading them. All these books, all these manuscripts that you've been going through, they're just to describe what you're about to do. And now you can start basically doing your, you know, your cloud work and to actually understand God in a way that isn't written in front of you in a book. So it's kind of weird, but at that moment when you've been studying this thing for like 2-3 years and they tell you, well, everything you've read, put aside, it's a bit disappointing, but it's, you also see the bittersweet, you know, use of it, that, okay, now I know why, because I know what to expect when I go up there. And then they really show you, basically.
So I don't know if we talk about this later, but what is, like, what's the cloud world? Like, is that,
should I not ask that?
Okay.
We talked about it in the original show, but it's essentially like Plato's world of forms. I mean, if you're thinking about it philosophically.
Okay.
It's so much more.
It's where you go when you astral travel and get out of...
Do you explain that later?
I can. I mean, I can explain it right now.
Because it's just interesting to me.
It's... Have you studied the Kabbalah?
I have.
It's the Atzilut. It's the archetypal living world of forms, the world of Mithal from Sufism, the... it's basically the mind of God.
So is it right? Is it like the mental plane?
No, he said it was Atzilut, so that oftentimes encompasses the sphere of Chokhmah, and it's the outflowing of light from Kether.
Hmm.
The cosmology has seven layers. The first four are, if we're going to dive deep into the Kabbalah, let's do it right now. And the world that we have. So in the very center.
I don't want to sideline us, though.
This is perfect. This is actually really good because this is going to give a clear view about what we mean when we say cloud world and the realm of ideas and stuff like that. This is what Plato was talking about. This is what the Sufis talk about. It's all the same, and even the Kabbalists. So in the let's call it upper dimension. For the sake of example, let's call it upper dimension. There's a mental being, right? It's alive. It's a living thing. It does not have a body, but it's alive. No meat suit, just living thought. And in the middle of it, there's the center where the light emanates from. That's what the tree of life, if we're going to go there, it's the Ayn, the very center, the very place of, still nothingness, contained all the sentient life of everything. From there emits the first layer, the second, the third, and then Keter, right? The crown.
Yeah.
Okay. These four, in our cosmology, we call them the I Am, the Akun, the Ana, the thing, the center of God, let's say. From there is what Plato, the Hindus, and the Sufis have been studying throughout their religions and their philosophies. The world of archetypes, the world of forms, the primordial sea of the Egyptians, the Sa'd, that's after that. That's anything underneath the Sfira of Bina and all the way down to Malkut. That's the worlds of, was it Ria? What was it? Yetzirah? Those, the other three worlds, right?
Yeah, you skipped Dot.
That's not a world.
That's a whole different thing. That's where all the spheres basically switch polarity and they go apeshit. But no, what we study is how to travel. If we're going to talk in Kabbalah terms, you are to go through Tiferet to understand the Ein Sof Or. That's the main gist of it in Kabbalistic terms.
Okay, I think I get it.
Going to Tifereth makes some sense to me because it's often said that that's where one's holy guardian angel resides, and the first goal of the magician is to make conversation with one's holy guardian angel, to get to know this angel. And so it sounds like your wisdom is syncretic. It comes from various different cultures, and there's lots of different wisdom traditions we could look at to get an idea of what is taught in your system.
Yes, that's very, very true. If you meet an Alawite or Alawi or someone from Ahr al-Najm, and they tell you, well, we have this and we have that, just stop them right there, because we don't have anything. What we have is a collection, let's say, of 10,000 years worth of cultural dissection. We go through everything around and we see what has been proven to fit in our cosmology, which we inherited from, the Sumerians. The language will be different. I mean, the books, there are plenty. The language will be different. The cultures gave them different names. I mean, take, for example, the parallel which I gave you earlier about the Yaoim and Yaldabaoth, from the Gnosticism, basically. Our demiurge, Yaoim, reached... I mean, you can see where I'm going with this when I give you the example. So he reached to the world of Al-Adhilla, the place of shadows. And from there, he siphoned seven strong and mighty sultans. Does that sound familiar? You know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, absolutely.
So everybody had their own fairy tale for the same event, right? Everybody had their own...
Totally.
The Kabbalists do the same thing. So with these books that we have, or where we study, they just try to find the comparisons between everything.
Yeah, because there is a lot of comparisons and similarities.
Oh, yeah.
It's all the same river just flowing differently.
I heard in another interview that you did that you mentioned four books. Are these books source texts that you use above all others? And if so, what's your favorite passage? I'm very curious about this, so please share.
I'm gladly. If you mean strictly from the Alawiya or from the Khassa literature of the Alawiya, we have essential, core. One of them is the Kitab al-Usus, Kitab Dalam, which is very forbidden. The Book of Dastur, the Book of Al-Yunan. And I'm going to go back to the Dalam soon and tell you why. And then lastly, we have, for example, the Mawarid. That's also another good book. The four ones which we, you know, which we dive into a lot are Dalam, Destur, Book of Enoch, and Elusos, because they contain our cosmology to the fullest. But if you mean from like the chain of light that Sesle Talim Nur that I mentioned before, it would take like 10 minutes to list everything from those
books.
Did
you say the Book of Enoch?
Yeah, we do. We study it in a symbolic sense.
Awesome.
Because
that's awesome.
Because we believe that he kind of ascended in a way. But his story is a funny one. It's like an allegory for the mind overcoming the smoke and becoming one with the stars. So he's a prime example of that. You know, Akhnouch is a very prime example of that. But yeah. So as for the books from the Sesle Ta'alim al-Nur, we have a whole bunch of stuff, like a myriad of Ismaili, Harrani, Sabbatian, like Kabbalah. We have a lot of those. But as for the Kabbalah, we don't really go into the Talmud or anything like Judaic. We're mostly concerned with the worlds of formation and you know, how to access it and the Tree of Life and stuff like that. But yeah, so you asked about like favorite passages. I can give three from, yeah, one of them is from like... Abdesar al-Kafiya, there's a passage where like, there's a message that arrives to the like a man having some kind of a seizure. And it says, "Behold within you, seeker, who drowns in your own sea, that you believe to be the cone or like the world, should find truth in you and who you are and where you're going, where your light is and where it's coming from. What river do you stem from?" And by this, they mean, you know, the I am. Find truth in knowing your origin point. That's one of my favorite passages. It's actually one of the passages that got me hooked into this and made me ask for more, you know, knowledge. And from, I would say from literature outside the Alawiya, there's the, I think it was from the fifth Corpus Hermeticum. I'm not really sure. Message from Idris to his son. Idris being like Hermes, you know. And he says, this is the passage. "This is God, who is greater than any name. This is the God, invisible and entirely visible. This is God, who is evident to the eyes, may be seen by the mind. He is the bodiless, and he is many-bodied in the same time. Or rather, he's all-bodied. There's nothing that he is not, for he is also all that is. This is why he has all names, because they are all one father. And this is why he has no name, because he's the father of them all." Over here, Idris is trying to teach his kid about the hermetic concept of the first. And I love that one. Because it basically describes also our interpretation of like hermetic oneness, right? The final passage which I would like to share with you is, it's from a forbidden book, so I can't really read the passage for two reasons, because like I want to keep my head on my shoulder, and because the passage itself is really, really long, but it details the absolute pure hateful butchery of this one demiurge performing like a hostile takeover of Earth over another. So before the current demiurge that we have now, we had another one called Dalam, right? And the one we have now came and he basically butchered everything, ate everything, devoured like prime theophagy, and he harvested every living soul. All the Atlanteans that you're wondering where they are, they're all in his belly right now.
Right?
Oh,
and they,
wow.
Yeah, and they got turned into like servitor, like familiars, right? He made their souls into the jinn or the jinnah. So that's when I read that was like so heavy metal. It was so badass when I read
that's
it.
That's brutal.
Yeah, I was young too, yeah. So yeah, those are my like three favorite passages.
Yeah, that really grabbed me in the first episode we did, and I'm just like craving to know all about that previous demiurge and all of the subjects and whatever. But oh, Atlanteans, that makes so much sense.
I mean, I only joke about the Atlanteans. I have absolutely no idea where Atlantis is, nor do any of our books like know to anything about that. I'm just saying that
it's just a cutoff point. I mean,
so it's like, yeah, you believe in the idea of Atlantis, you don't literally believe in Atlantis. Like
I found nothing actually. I looked in the books and I found nothing.
That's
like, no,
I feel the same way, man. Yeah. Like, I believe in the idea of Atlantis, but I don't believe in Atlantis.
However, I did not find Atlantis. I did not find any Lemuria, Bemuria, or anything freaky, but I did find a lot of like Dalamic, let's say, leftover tablets and things that are in languages that even we haven't translated yet. And they're all there in the mountain, basically. Weird shit.
Whoa.
Wow.
We need AI to translate it.
I mean, I'm hoping one day when the Civil War is over, and maybe there's going to be some kind of like an effort to do that. But people right now are too busy with other things over there.
I have to ask about the women's vault. Are women allowed to practice? And if so, are they given equal status and access as much as male students?
Yes. Thank you so much for asking that, because from the previous show, there was like a thing which I felt like I needed to clear, you know. So yes, women have equal access and equal status. And if they come to like, you know, if they want to learn the faith or any woman, any, you know, seeker that reaches the assembly through a proposer and asks for it, then they can receive it. There's no barrier whatsoever. And I know that there's like this, like, idiotic jokes that we made on the threads and everything like that about the soul degrading into women and stuff, but it wasn't really meant in the sense that a man is worth two women or anything like that. It was mostly because in the upper world, in the cloud, the women and men are not exactly women and men. They're basically just cloud essences. They're instances in the mind of God. But, however, there is the projecting, the giving, the, I would say, extrovert, maybe? I don't know how to explain it. There's the projecting and the siphoning, right? And there's the receiving aspect is a woman, and the giving aspect is male, kinda. So that's what I meant when I said that they shatter into two and stuff like that. But there's no, like, culturally, women are the most, the Syrian Alawiyun women are the most culturally and religiously liberal in the entire Middle East, maybe, along with like women in Israel, maybe, I'm not really sure. But yeah, so they can learn, they can teach also. It's doable that, for example, you know, a mother or a sister or an aunt wants to pursue being an elder, you know, like an aunt.
That's beautiful.
You know, like, yeah, but I mean, to be fair, this is all like nerdy shit that males do, and like women are kind of like mostly above this, and they're just like, ah, okay. Let the boys have them. Yeah, you know, let the boys have their fun. And what's funny is that most of the world thinks that, okay, a woman is not really prepared for this, or they're like weaker or anything like that. It has been thoroughly proven that women have a much stronger connection to the cloud than males. So a woman can have projections easier. I don't know why, but it is what it is. Maybe they're more intuitive. Maybe they're more, you know, in tune with it.
Definitely more
intuitive. Basically, yeah, we're basically mostly just, you know, lost in our own hubris and bullshit, and they remember. You should see the dream journals that my wife has and the ones I have. I like write two paragraphs and she writes like three pages, you know what I mean?
My wife does that, yeah. Too,
exactly.
Yeah,
I write like a paragraph and she goes and writes the story.
Exactly, they're more able to travel. And but I would say maybe they culturally, they in Syria, because there's like these antiquated kind of old Arabic gender roles there, so women are too busy with that shit to deal with, you know, teaching Alawiyah and Ahl al-Najm and stuff like that. Most women, my sister for example, my very own sister, she knows and she has learned, and she's like, okay, you guys have fun. That's it. You know, that's yeah.
You know, it's funny what you're saying, yeah, is represented in the Rider-Waite tarot with the lover's card, where Adam is looking over to Eve, and Eve can see above the cloud that's obscuring Adam, and she can see the angel.
Totally.
The gender in the cloud kind of reminds me a little bit of the zero and the one of Thelema. And I think this is maybe also similar to the concepts that we explored in the Gospels of Thomas episode regarding active and passive spirituality.
Yeah. Right off the bat, if I come across any type of like religious belief system that holds women or men like one above the other, it instantly just screams bullshit to me. Like, this is garbage.
This is just a meat suit, man. We're just driving cars.
We're the same thing. We're just opposites. Same coin.
Right.
Wait, so do you call your female elders aunt, or do you still call them uncle?
We call them amma, aunt. Exactly.
Amma.
I want to be amma. An aunt someday.
I like that.
You can do that. You can actually do that. I mean, I don't know where you live, but if you find like Khassab communities, I mean, there's one in Australia and one in Brazil.
I'd be one of the weird women that want to do it. It's super interested.
That'd be fun too.
Say uncle.
I can't wait for my initiation to get the shit beat out of me.
Is that where the whole say uncle thing came from? I think it is.
Yeah. Oh,
dude,
yeah.
Also, the Knights Templar came from these guys. Holy shit.
Oh, no.
No, I've already gone with that. I feel like I've learned this great secret.
We've sat on like balconies and porches and stuff like that with Templar folk, and we just put the swords down, you know, after a long day of protecting the pilgrims, and we've had some blue cheese and like some weird herb tea back then and discussed the mind of God. But that's all there is, just cultural exchange. I'm not, you know, that's all there is to it. What do you think? You think the friends down there in Jerusalem are correct, or and they were like, no, well, we think the ones in Greece were more. It's like just, you know, people having fun and talking, that's all.
What if you'd like to hear more about the secret religion of the Alawiyah, especially concerning their cosmology, their specific practices, and how they deal with deities and demons? Please visit www.patreon.com/thewholerabbit, where your monthly donation of just $5 will not only get you the extended version of this episode, but all of our extended episodes going back before the 20s. Also new 5x5 high quality vinyl sticker of our Big Bunny Baphomet cover art, and you'll get the secret keys to our Discord server, where you can hang out with us and Alawite Alnon as well, because he hangs out with us there.
Yeah, you're not going to want to miss this stuff. It's awesome.
So thank you for coming on the show with us today. We hope that we'll take a quick break and be back for part two, yeah?
Yep, 5-minute break.
Sounds excellent.
Thank you, everybody. Eat carrots and shoot lasers.
Pew, pew, pew.